Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. This is Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical discussion, debate, dialogue, healthcare, science in the news, answers to your emails, and your calls, all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. So please stay tuned. But before we go any further, let me remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. Well, some interesting things this week, and I wanted to start with just talking a little bit about the healthcare reform things that go into effect, and a couple of, well, little devil-y details that have emerged, specifically out there to you parents and college-age people, or at least young people under the age of 26. One of the things that's happened was that as of September 1st, parents can keep you on the health plan until you're 26, or you can keep your child on your health plan until they're 26, depending on your perspective on that one. And that's actually a good thing, because a follow-up article that I was reading this week talking about this issue pointed out that many of the college plans that have been the default position for young people are actually pretty minimalist. And some of them have actually very bad coverage, lifetime benefits that are quite low. The worst one that they cite here has like a $5,000 limit for injury or illness, and you have to go through student health or the coverage doesn't kick in at all. No emergency room care, excuse me. It's not really a health plan if you have to wait till student health opens up with a broken leg. Good insurance plans should cover a lot more than that. That's one detail. And the other one is that although the law goes into effect on the 1st of September, if your health plan doesn't renew until, let's say, January 1st, then for the rest of this plan year, your child needs to be on a different policy. They will not be able to be on your policy until January 1st. Extremely important for parents to understand that. And if you're going to use the school policy, some suggestions that one should ask, and this is true, of course, after you have the decision, do I keep them on my health plan or do I let them use the school policy? And here's some questions to think about. What's the maximum benefit for the policy? Are prescriptions and mental health services included, and what would be the restrictions there? What happens if the child goes abroad or leaves school? Does the healthcare coverage evaporate, or is there a transition period? What is the loss ratio? And the loss ratio means what percentage of the premiums actually goes to pay for healthcare services. You can write a policy where people put a lot of money in, but only a little money comes out, and that would have a low loss ratio. Realistically, you're looking for a loss ratio of 80% or more for an honest dealing health plan. And the last is on-campus services, checkups, flu shot, overlap with existing coverage. So the most important thing is if someone gets sick, let's suppose they get cancer and have to leave school. If their only health insurance is the campus plan, they could be high and dry. So it's very important to know those details. Furthermore, if you do decide to keep your child on your health plan, you need to sign a waiver so that you don't automatically get charged for the campus health plan. Some of the local campuses, including, there was a story here about UC Berkeley discussing one person who, well, she was a poli-sci major at Berkeley and she got a rare form of cancer, and Berkeley's plan ended up not covering her MRI, her PET scan, or many of her blood tests because, well, it wasn't covered benefit. You don't want to be in that situation. Other provisions for the health care bill that take effect. One thing I was, as a small business person who's been sweating to meet premiums for my employees, there is a tax credit this year to, let's see, firms with fewer than 25 full-time workers who are paying for health insurance. So I'll be very happy to see a tax credit. And there's a lot of small businesses in Monterey and Santa Cruz and areas in between who should look very carefully at that. Other provisions, hey, if a child has cancer, you can't refuse to cover them if you're covering the parents. You can't refuse to cover children with pre-existing conditions. That's a real deal breaker for some people. Enough said on that. Other things that happen, no more annual or lifetime spending limits for medical benefits. That's a really important one for people who get a devastating disease that can be treated but needs expensive treatment. And preventing insurers from dropping individuals after they get sick, except in cases of fraud. I hope that they're going to mean meaningful fraud, not forgetting that you had a sore throat in 1972 and went to the emergency room. The sorts of fraud that are alleged by the health plans when they try to drop someone are sometimes just obvious paperwork or administrative things and are not meaningful fraud. But, you know, if you put 16 investigators on you and go through all of your paperwork with a fine-tooth comb, I bet everybody could find evidence for fraud in anyone's application for anything. All that being said, of course, there's action in Congress from the Republicans. Part of the plan that they announced is they're going to try and repeal the mandate. The employer mandate is going to go away, and the personal individual mandate is going to go away if the Republicans are successful. So that's their party platform. It'll be interesting to see what the health insurance company says about going after the mandate, because I actually think the health insurance companies like that individual mandate making everyone have to have health insurance. That's going to bring a whole bunch of people into the fold and improve the loss ratio for those companies, because the healthier people are going to be required to get health insurance, not just the people who think they might need it. Well, that's a good idea from an actuarial standpoint, and it'll be interesting to see how the Republicans parse out that one, because, of course, I can see lots of lobbyists heading off to Washington saying, you know, we've thought about that mandate thing, and we're going to support that one. Stay tuned. It'll be nothing if not interesting. Coming up a little later in the program, some new stories about breast cancer and mammograms, and also some information about strategies for avoiding catching the flu this winter. Thought we'd roll out with a email from Debbie in Carmel. Hornet sting and prolonged itching. I was stung by a black hornet twice in the back of the neck, about an inch above the hairline, halfway between the ear and the center line of the neck. That was 8 weeks ago. There is still some thickening of the skin at the sting sites. It doesn't seem to be infected, and there's no longer any reddening, and there doesn't seem to be a stinger in the skin, but it itches like crazy a few times every day. I did kill this particular hornet, so I did see it, and I am confident re my designation of it as a hornet. I'd been stung two additional times by hornets since then. I run a lot of trails, with the usual itching for 3 or 4 days, and that's it. I've never had an allergic reaction before to bee or hornet stings. Why is my reaction to these stings so different from my others? And should I be concerned enough to see a doctor, will the itching eventually go away? I occasionally use a cortisone cream to relieve the itching, but I don't want to overuse this product. Well, Debbie, 8 weeks is a long time to have persistent induration. Induration, by the way, folks, is a kind of woody quality that flesh gets when it's full of fluid or white blood cells. And the location of the sting on the scalp may have something to do with why Debbie is having such a persistent reaction. That area is very, very thick, and it has a couple of structural layers, kind of sheets of collagenous material that don't exist elsewhere on the body. They're designed to help protect the head and are also involved in cooling, because the scalp turns out to be a major radiator of heat. So fluid in one of those layers might persist for a longer time. The other possibility is that the hornet hit a blood vessel and that you bled deeply under one of these layers. And as anyone who's ever had a bump on the head knows, if you get a goose egg, as it's called, those can persist for a very long time because blood is very, very slow to clear from the scalp. I would suggest massaging the area and seeing if you can speed up the resolution. And I think eventually it will go away. You ask if you should see a doctor, and you know, I don't think it's such a bad idea to have it looked at, although I'm having a hard time imagining what could be a problem that would really require, let's say, a surgical procedure to open up and drain it. So in general, I would reassure you, but I do think 8 weeks is a long time, so it might be worth seeing a physician just because, obviously, you can't practice medicine over the telephone or over the radio. There were a couple of really interesting stories this week about breast cancer. And the one that several of my patients asked me about was actually, I thought, intriguing. And I have to really pull the article. I just looked it up and all I have is an abstract. So let me give you the background and then tell you my concerns about this article. Article published in this week's New England Journal of Medicine cites a Norwegian study which set off a controversy by suggesting that the benefits of mammography might not be very great. Previous studies that were done years ago showed that mammograms reduced mortality from breast cancer by about 25%, presumably from earlier detection and thus catching the disease before it could be felt and therefore catching it before it had spread. And that was the thinking. Now, there's an issue of something called lead time bias, which has generated a lot of controversy. And lead time bias also gets us on the issue of prostate cancer. Let's suppose that I can't find the cancer until it's 1 inch wide, whichever cancer we're talking about. So all of the cancers that are less than an inch are going to be undetectable. Now, if I just start counting how long you live from the day that we identify your cancer, then some of the cancers will be lethal, some of this cancer will be curable, and in the long run, you'll have an average lifespan of people who have this cancer. If I now develop a new technology which lets me find that cancer earlier, let's say at the quarter of an inch stage, it's going to take several years for a quarter of an inch tumor to grow to the size of an inch. So initially, with my new technology, I'm going to find a lot of cancers, and it'll seem like the absolute incidence rate of cancer increases. Then over time, counting from the date of discovery, you will automatically have an improvement in lifespan of the cancer patients because they will have survival with their cancer at least those extra 2 years that it takes the cancer to get from a quarter to a 1 inch. That's what we call lead time bias in statistics. And it is the devil to figure out how that works with mammogram because, of course, therapies keep changing. What this study did was it looked at 40,000 Norwegian women between 1986 and 2005. Starting in 1996, Norway began offering mammograms to women between 50 and 69, and those that had breast cancer were assigned to a multidisciplinary treatment team, very similar to what we do in this country. But of course, in Norway, everybody's case is tracked, so they have much better statistics. What they found was that the women who had mammograms and were treated by the special teams had a 10% lower breast cancer death rate than similar women who had had neither. Now, they also found that the death rate fell by 8% in women over 70 who had the new treatments but had not been invited to have mammograms, which, if you do just a straight mathematical thing, would seem to apply that 8% of the benefit is due to the new therapies, which, reading between the lines here on this abstract, the new therapies are hormone inhibitors, either aromatase inhibitors, which prevent the conversion of testosterone into estrogen, or estrogen blockers like tamoxifen or raloxifen that keep the estrogen from having a stimulatory effect on the breast cancer cell's growth. And it could be either one of those drugs being used in Norway, I don't actually know, but assuming it's tamoxifen, that will increase the survival time by slowing down the rate of any residual cancer. And if the woman dies of something else during that interval, then she would be presumed to be a cured cancer. So the question really is, does the mammogram confer any additional benefit? The trouble with the study and the thing that I think may be a colossal misunderstanding by the American media on this, because I've seen several stories talking about this and none of them have thought of this, is that we're not really talking about women who don't have breast cancer. We're saying that mammograms don't benefit women who have breast cancer. And yeah, I can totally buy that, because if you've got breast cancer, you're going to be treated with these hormones, and additional mammograms are really not going to change the management, and the rate of recurrent cancer is going to be too low to show a benefit from those mammograms. So what? I think that people have actually thought that this study had something to do with women who don't have breast cancer. And I'm really afraid that it's being deeply misinterpreted. So I invite you to do what I'm going to be doing in the next week, which is getting the full text of this article and reviewing it carefully for the methods section, and then thinking about, can we extrapolate this information to the population at large? I'm thinking that this is what we call in statistics a generalization error. And I'm certainly hoping that that's not the case. And I'll be happy to retract my misgivings if that is indeed what I want to do next week. So stay tuned. We've actually got a cliffhanger here. Speaking of reading the full article, you heard it here first years ago in about 2006 when a study was published suggesting that breast cancer rates in the United States had fallen drastically after many women stopped using hormone replacement therapy in 2002 after the first Women's Health Initiative article was published. And I remember that very clearly because there was such huge and colossal trauma in the land at the time of the publication of that article, which seemed to suggest that taking estrogen caused breast cancer. Well, actually, it was women taking Prempro, but how it was spun in the media was women taking estrogen. Then many people stopped using their hormone replacement therapy. And about 4 or 5 years later, an article came back saying that breast cancer rates in the United States had dropped quite a lot. It was perhaps a 20 to 30% drop, and saying that this was due to all of the women stopping estrogen. But of course, the problem was that we know that a breast cancer that we find today in 2010 got started in 2000. So what you do in 2007 isn't going to unmake that breast cancer. We know this. We know the natural history of the disease. And I suggested at that time that probably this was because the breast cancers that were estrogen sensitive were responding to the estrogen by growing faster. And so they were being found sooner, a sort of spin on this whole lead time bias concept. And you heard it here first, just out this week in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, and not, I might add, making headline news, the Canadian Cancer Society published their data showing that between 2002 and 2004, there was a 10% decrease in new breast cancer diagnoses in women from 50 to 56. Subsequently, after 2004, the rate of breast cancer started to go back up again and has now gotten back up to almost the same level it was before 2002, implying to me that indeed all of these changes in breast cancer rate were due to lead time bias associated with the detection thresholds for breast cancer using mammography or breast self-exam, and not in fact showing a real benefit long-term to having stopped the estrogen. We're going to do another email now. This one is from Margaret in Santa Cruz. Margaret wanted to comment on the ADHD study that we talked about last week, where we were discussing that pesticide exposure, particularly to organophosphate acetylcholinesterase inhibitor type pesticides, was related to a higher rate of ADHD in 5-year-olds when the blood of their mothers when pregnant was evaluated. And Margaret wanted me to emphasize that many men and women in the Salinas Valley are farm workers and therefore exposed to high doses of pesticides and herbicides in the fields. And yes, Margaret, that was why they chose to cite it in Salinas Valley, because they were looking for a proof of concept. My point was that I didn't want people taking that information and being afraid to eat fruits and vegetables. Just wanted to make sure that they understood that washing the fruits and vegetables would remove enough of the residue, and the benefit of the fruits and vegetables is very great. The next story I wanted to talk to you about was flu, as promised. Now, we've known for quite some time that flu virus is associated with a seasonal transmission. Even if flu virus is out and about, it's actually harder to catch in certain environmental conditions. Specifically, flu virus breeds and spreads optimally in cold, dry weather. I should qualify that to say that it spreads optimally in cold, dry weather. And once it gets into the person's respiratory epithelium, cold, dry weather helps it penetrate that epithelium and infect. So in both cases, cold, dry means about 41 degrees Fahrenheit and 20% humidity. Now, researchers have looked at what does it take to stop transmission, and it turns out 86 degrees Fahrenheit or a humidity to 80% completely stops the transmission of the flu. So why does humidity make a difference? When we breathe in the flu, the inhaled virus particles that are floating in the air are what can infect us. And as the humidity rises, there's more water in the air, and the flu particles actually get caught by the water droplets, which then act like a pair of cement overshoes to drag the flu virus to the bottom. So this is a very important distinction. So think about the dry air, the flu virus particles can remain airborne for longer after someone coughs them out. And so it's as if it was increasing the dose of virus in the atmosphere. So the more humid it is, the lower you get. Humidifying the air in nursing homes has been shown to reduce flu transmission. So even the amount of humidification that you can get with a single room humidifier does make a difference as far as infection rates. Another thing that happens in a warm place is that the animals, like for example guinea pigs, stop transmitting flu virus a couple of days earlier than if you're in a cool place. So the cool respiratory passageways allow the virus to keep replicating, as I've said. So one of the things besides getting a flu shot that you might look at is when you're outside in cold weather, and let's call it under 70 degrees. So when you're outside under 70 degrees and someone is coughing or sneezing, that's the time to really distance yourself from the individual if you're standing outside. Because even though, of course, the air is going to dissipate fairly rapidly, a group of people kind of huddled together in a bus stop or some other similar circumstance in line waiting to get into the theater or get into a football game, whatever. Those are the sorts of situations where you actually are at rather more risk than you would think. The other thing I'm thinking of is it's time for me to get a humidifier and put it in my waiting room and maybe crank up the heat so that I stay above that magic 70 through the winter, because I'm convinced a lot of people catch the flu virus waiting in line to get their flu shot, which accounts for the number of cases of people who got the flu shot right after their flu virus. They were possibly incubating too. But when you get the flu shot, it takes a couple weeks to have protective antibody. So if you get your flu shot at the same time that you get a good size inoculum of flu, you are going to get the flu before the flu shot has a chance to protect you. Another interesting thing that research on the flu shows is that the virus in a cold room, so let's say under 70 degrees and low humidity, the virus remained infectious for up to 13 days on glass, metal, and soil. But on porous surfaces like soil, the sun actually doesn't destroy the flu virus, but you can get rid of it with ultraviolet surfaces. If you put the glass or metal out in the sun, it will clean it off. So room humidifiers, very important. Oh, and statistically, you drop the risk of, with a humidifier, you drop the virus counts by 30% by using just a small humidifier. Now, one caveat about the use of humidifiers, they do potentially increase the risk of mold. So people who have mold allergies might want to look at other tactics like mixing the air, cleaning out the air in their rooms, and it's certainly isolating the air of the sick people from the healthy people, if you can possibly do that. And it's looking like flu. And how do you know it's flu? Well, body aches and fever in adults, not something you get with a cold. Body aches, fever, and respiratory symptoms treated as flu, especially now that we're heading into the season. And you know what? I think we did dodge a bullet last year. The H1N1 virus was not as ravenous and transmissible by the time we got it in the winter. And we had an extraordinarily warm winter, global warming commons aside. We had a very, very mild winter. In fact, our fruit trees didn't set fruit very well because of it. But we didn't have very much influenza, I think, also because we had that higher temperature and didn't get into the cold, dry air situation, which sometimes occurs. Let's go now to Rudy in Monterey. Hi, Rudy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. What can I do for you?
Well, I have a new condition in my mouth. After taking niacin to lower cholesterol, I wasn't able to take statins for adverse effects. And so I was put on a very mild dose of niacin, which I stopped maybe 6 weeks after taking, because it just was very difficult to take. And then I came up with this, what I want to call is dead mouth, sort of a dead mouth syndrome, a poor taste, very dry, funny feeling in my mouth.
Really? That's very interesting. How long after you started the niacin did you develop this?
I don't know exactly.
Well, ballpark it.
I would say maybe 2 weeks.
Okay. So certainly plausible. And had you developed it before you stopped the niacin?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was getting very dry mouth when bicycling.
What about ulcers or sores in your mouth? Any blistering?
It does feel sore, but the only way I could describe the inside of my mouth would be like very bright red, sort of inflamed.
It
feels like cracks in the corner of my mouth, but people don't see it.
All right. I understand what you're saying with that sensation. This is interesting, and there could be a connection to the niacin. Certainly a direct reaction of some kind is plausible, and stopping the agent is the way to go. If it's due to the niacin and you stop the niacin, it shouldn't persist for more than 2 or 3 weeks, given the oral epithelium replacement rate. Did you have any dental work of any kind done during the weeks leading up to the beginning of this? You should look in your schedule book and see if it could be related to a dental procedure. And it could be a complete coincidence, and you've developed a sensitivity to your toothpaste or mouthwash or some other thing in your environment that's perpetuating this. And if it doesn't go away after a couple weeks off the niacin, then you have to pursue these other things. Another thing that you would probably want to get would be a red blood cell zinc level, just to make sure that your zinc is okay. You don't have a lot of GI problems, or I presume you haven't said anything about that. You don't have ulcers.
No, actually, I do. I have food allergies.
Okay. Well, the reason I asked is because food sensitivities can definitely manifest as an oral thing. So you may have developed a new sensitivity to something that's commonly in your diet, and that can be a bear to figure out. So it may or may not be related to the niacin, and that would be how I would tease those apart. With respect to your cholesterol, let's talk about that. You said you couldn't tolerate statins, so you were put on niacin and you didn't tolerate niacin. You used very low-dose niacin and worked your way up. Exactly what protocol did your doctor use?
Well, he said to start with 500 milligrams a day and then double that in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
I never got past 250.
Right. Let me tell you how I do it, because I think that many doctors make the error of giving people too high a dose. I start people off with a little baby aspirin and 100 milligrams of niacin. And I have them do that once a day for 4 or 5 days to make sure that they're not going to flush from that. Then I have them take that to 2, then 3 times a day, always with food, and another baby aspirin, yes. So they're getting a total of 240 milligrams of aspirin, which is less than one aspirin tablet. So I'm not worried about the aspirin dose. But that little bit of aspirin into the system before you take the niacin does seem to help reduce the flushing. If you can get up to 300 milligrams a day, then each week you add 100 milligrams. And if you're doing well with that, you can go faster. But that's my, I can't take niacin titration protocol. And it works. You give the body enough time to adapt to the increasing doses of niacin by going up slowly like that. And most people using that protocol can get up to 1,500 or 2,000 milligrams before they start to flush. Now, in your case, because we're wondering if the niacin was causal, we wouldn't do that without waiting till your mouth gets better, and then maybe doing a second challenge with niacin. And if you have another reaction, and if it stops when you stop niacin, and then it comes back when you resume niacin, then you're out for niacin, because a reaction like that can actually magnify into something potentially quite serious called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Yeah, you can look that up. We usually see it with drugs, but essentially, imagine a third-degree burn from the opening of your mouth to your anus. And in extreme cases, your entire oral and intestinal cavity completely ulcerates on the inside. It's lethal. It can be lethal. It's a terrible, terrible reaction. It's an idiosyncratic drug reaction, but it can also relate to high doses of any nutrient, because once you take a nutrient and give it at supernormal levels, like we're doing with niacin, you've turned it into a drug. Hopefully a safe drug, but a drug nonetheless.
I got it.
So in the short run, pick yourself up some DGL, which is deglycerized licorice, and suck on DGL and rinse your mouth with aloe vera. And those things will set up barriers. They'll comfort you a little bit, make your mouth feel better while you're waiting for it to heal.
Okay, DGL and aloe vera.
Yeah.
Okay, very thorough answer. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and have a nice day. Bye-bye. And let's go to our next caller, who is Roy in Carmel. Hello, Roy, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have concerns about something that everybody's heard about in the last five or six years called trans fats, which were sort of a secret fat that they didn't tell us about for quite some time. And
I'd love to meet them. Wouldn't you just love to give them a talking to?
Well, them actually is the FDA, but their scientists suggested that they should at least put it on the label, if not warn people about it. And I've heard that 30 years ago, the animal husbandry business started using trans fats in their feed for cheap calories and found that their animals got sick, so they banned it. That was almost 25, 30 years ago, but for us, it's still there. As I understand it, and I want your understanding of it if you have a chance to say it, is that I was a chemistry major, and I know polarized light goes through things and bends different ways, and there's left and right cis and trans.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, as I understand it, natural fats are all in the cis bend, and trans fats, although they have the same chemical composition as natural fats, they're bent.
Right.
And when your body tries to use it in cell membranes and stuff, it doesn't work very well. So what's your read on it, and why don't they really tell us, from your estimation of the FDA, not that there's 0 grams in food, but there's no trans fat. And 0 grams doesn't mean no, it just means not a gram per serving. But anyway, help me.
Okay, well, let's start with Napoleon, which may seem like a non sequitur, but actually it's not. Napoleon was a very scientific fellow. He actually had some of the first organized state-sponsored science happened in France, and, you know, all that archaeology. But back at home, the chemists were hard at work trying to improve the war machine. And one of the problems with an army is, you may have heard it from Napoleon, an army travels on its stomach. So he had food scientists, some of the first, and they invented trans fats because bacteria can't eat trans fats. They don't go rancid. They last a very, very long time. So if you
That's probably poisonous for them, too, then.
Bingo. But it does provide calories. And so we are able to use it for calories. We don't use it very well or efficiently, and it tends to be stored. And once trans fats are stored, it's very hard to get them back out of fat. And that would include out of fat in your butt or fat in your arteries. So that's a piece of the physiology. But it was really good for long-term storage. And that is exactly what's happening in our bodies, long-term storage. But the long-term storage, obviously, is not so desirable. Back to the actual biochemistry, when fats are built, either in a form that is in a plant or a form that is in an animal, they're built by enzymes, enzymatic processes, and they are built with cis bonds. So, in other words, the active groups are kinked in a certain way. And you've got, I can't describe a chemical bond here on the air. It's impossible. But essentially, you start out with unsaturated fats, folks, which are, I'm going to use the chain link metaphor. You've got a link of chains, and instead of one chain, every now and then you've got two links. So you've got double links, and that's an unsaturated fat. The omega-6, the omega-3s, these are unsaturated fats. When you think about olive oil, that's got one double link chain in it. but the polyunsaturated fats, which would be, for example, corn oil from corn, have multiple double links. The problem with this stuff is it is good bacteria chow, and it does go rancid. So you can bombard it with hydrogen. When you do that, you end up attaching, you end up losing those double links and throwing a hydrogen group on either side. And under natural processes, the hydrogens are going to go on the same side of the link. So when we saturate an unsaturated bond as part of our breaking down of fat, both hydrogens go on the same side. In the case of a trans fat, one goes on one side and one goes on the other side. And then the thing doesn't fit into our enzymes very well. It's actually what we call a stereoisomer problem. The physical structure of the fat doesn't get into the enzymes well. So we tend to accumulate the trans fat that we don't burn. And we don't burn it first. We burn the other fats first. And what's left that doesn't get burnt gets stored. And once it's stored, very hard to get it back out again.
Well, the thing that concerns me is the attempt of your body when it needs the fat. I don't know that it, which bent it's got when it tries to use it and it builds a cell with it. The cell doesn't function well.
The cell's membrane is stiffer. Exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't function in its job. Apparently, and when I looked up the definition of poison in the medical dictionary, it says disruption of these processes in life are done by poison. It's actually the scientific definition, according to the scientific dictionary, is trans fats are poison.
Well, you know, that's a little extreme, and I'll tell you why. Salt, water, both of which in excess are poisons by that definition.
This isn't excess. This is any. Any of it's a poison.
Yeah,
I mean, it doesn't work. That's the point. You know, just like mercury, you can live with a lot of mercury, but any more mercury is poisonous.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. You're questioning the FDA. What's the question here? Why did it take the FDA so long to get around to
doing this?
No, I
know, they're crooked. I mean, let's put it this way. They're influenced heavily by corporate food processors, and trans fats are excellent preservatives because they're poison, and even the molds and the funguses and the bacteria have a hard time using it. But what I'm concerned about is, still, to this date, the FDA hasn't said anything about it. Just all they did was require the food companies to mention it on their label, and it turns out that if it's less than a gram, they can say 0 grams per serving.
Right.
And I noticed when I became sensitized to this, that the number of cookies that are called a serving got smaller when they didn't reduce the level of trans fat. They just made the serving size smaller.
Well, yeah, the serving size, you want to talk about poisons, let's talk about cookies. But anyway, very good point, and thank you for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Frank in Santa Cruz. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me. Months ago, you were talking about people dealing with problems of itching, and I was having a problem myself. My friend had stayed with friends and had contracted scabies, which was then transferred to me. And we took a treatment for it. I think it was called permethrin.
Yes.
And we used a cream, and the itching didn't stop. So they suggested try the cream again. They went through a number of tests. They tried to see whether we were allergic to things. And then finally a dermatologist at Kaiser gave us a pill version of it that's usually given to animals. But he had us take it for 3 weeks in a row. And it worked. The itching stopped. I believe it was that, but something related. I took niacin for years, and my doctor at Kaiser said I had a problem with vitamin B. I should discontinue it, and as I understand it, niacin is B. So I stopped that, and that was concurrent with it. I did try taking the niacin again, and the itching returned, so I stopped it immediately. So that's it.
Okay, when you say you tried taking the niacin again and the itching recurred, that's separate from the scabies question.
Yes, but not from the itching.
Got it. Okay. Just wanted to make sure because it wasn't entirely clear to me. So one question that you're asking is, can niacin make you itch? And yeah, absolutely it can, just like the fellow who thought it might be causing rawness in his mouth. What you do in this circumstance is stop the niacin, wait a while, re-challenge. You get the same reaction, then that's that. And if it's flushing, which is not an allergic reaction per se, you can sometimes sneak up on it using the titration schedule that I outlined earlier. With respect to your scabies, I'm impressed and a little alarmed that you were given veterinary medication to clear this infection, because, you know, you want to talk FDA approved and safe and effective. I get a little nervous using barnyard animal-based medicine on people. But scabies really is a nasty bug, and if your alternative is to use something that's even more toxic, I guess it's okay to do what he did. Yeah, I think you might have had a scabies that was relatively resistant to the pyrethrin, and so by taking it orally, you circulated it in your bloodstream, and it got into your skin at a higher concentration than was being achieved from the opposite direction. And probably the mite left of its own accord. I doubt you killed it. You probably just made yourself taste and smell so bad that the mite decided to head off for greener pastures.
Okay, well, it worked. And I just wanted to mention that. And this was these were dermatologists at Kaiser that said, well, let's try this. And the itching has stopped. And this has gone on now for several months now. And it's what a blessing when you're suffering from itching.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much, Frank.
You're so welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Owen in Carmel. Hello, Owen, and welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, well, we'll see. When I take a walk, if I walk more than 3 miles, my legs really ache. And when I exercise in the morning and lift up my legs, instead of my stomach starting to ache, I do it for stomach aches. My legs hurt. And I saw a doctor who's recommended an MRI, I think. I can hardly read what is on the thing. But
doctor's handwriting.
Is there a special kind of doctor who handles muscles or circulation?
Yeah, I'm worried about your circulation. The classic sort of thing of having your legs hurt when you elevate them.
I mean, I can do about 15 or 20.
Yeah.
And then they start to hurt.
Right. Well, I think what's happening is that the pipes are narrowed. And so when they have to travel uphill, they bother you. And when you use the muscles and the muscles need more blood, the pipes are too narrow to supply it. So the muscles are getting starved for blood and oxygen. This is called peripheral artery disease. And the phenomenon you describe is likely to be claudication. Now, it could be arthritis, in which case the pain would be confined to the joints. Typically, vascular problems, claudication, tend to occur at a predictable distance or a predictable load on the muscle. So you can walk, you know, a mile, okay, but 3 miles, bam, it hits. And then if you rest, once the pain goes away, you can probably walk 3 miles again.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah, and that's very characteristic of claudication. On the other hand, arthritis or other types of pain, once the pain kicks in and you rest and it goes away, when you get back up to try to walk again, the pain usually comes on much sooner. So I think it's peripheral artery disease, and the type of doctor that you should see is something called a vascular surgeon. We do something called an MR angiogram. There are other ways of doing it, but we always like to use the most expensive technology in our culture, so an MR angiogram is probably what the doctor ordered for you. And this uses a labeled compound to label your blood, but it's not an X-ray test, so there's no concern about high doses of radiation like we might have if we did a CT scan study.
So they inject some kind of color into my blood?
It's actually a form of metal. Usually they use something called gadolinium, which is an inert metal, but it has properties when you put it into a magnetic field that allow you to see it. And an MRI is a giant magnet, and all of the molecules in your body, all of the hydrogen oxygens, get suddenly pulled into one direction for a second, and then are allowed to relax less than a second,
well,
you know, a microsecond.
You eventually get rid of this stuff that they inject into
you? Oh, yeah, you do, although some of it deposits in your body fat and it comes out very slowly over time. You know, doing it for 25 years, and so far nobody's figured out anything bad about gadolinium as a contrast material.
What do they eventually do to ease the situation?
Depends on where the blockage is. If you've got like one area of plaque that's narrow, they can go in and stent it. They can go in and open it up, basically, and put a brace in there to keep it open. If it's a long area of narrowing, then you need a bypass, and they'll actually take a Gore-Tex blood vessel and shunt your blood, so you'll go around the blockage.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like much fun.
Well, it sounds like major surgery, but I wouldn't do it for fun. I would do it if I was impaired enough to need it. Now, walking 3 miles, that's pretty good. Would I do a bypass in order to walk 6 miles? Depends on how often I think I'm going to do that. Let's suppose you had a sore on your foot that wasn't healing. Well, then it's a no-brainer because you're going to lose the foot and end up amputating it if you can't heal the sore. So at that point, you're going to do a bypass on the person. So I think you're just at the beginning of the problem. So here's some ideas. First of all, hawthorn is an agent that has some benefit in helping with peripheral circulation, and you can buy that at the health food store. So that would be one thing to start taking. Another thing is high doses of fish oil, because what the other caller was saying about the omega-3s and the trans fats and all of that, if you can make the red blood cells a little bit more flexible, they can squeeze through the narrow spots a bit better. There's actually a drug called Trental, T-R-N-T-A-L, that is a pharmaceutical that does exactly that. It makes the blood vessels squishier and has some benefit in claudication. And the other thing is, if you exercise past the pain every day, so let's suppose it's 3 miles, so you take that last one block in real serious pain before you rest, and you do that every day, you get a little bit more blood vessels growing. So it's called collateral circulation. But it takes pain to cause that. So what I would suggest if you want to try this is get yourself a stopwatch, and when it starts to hurt, keep walking for another 30 seconds before you rest. And if you keep that up, I think you'll find that your distance starts to improve over several months, because that's how long it'll take.
Great. I can certainly walk through the pain.
Yeah. Why don't you
think it's going to disappear.
Well, get the MRI and find out if you've got a little area of blockage that's not extensive.
See.
You know, you'd fix that, so get that fixed. If you're looking at major surgery, then do the conservative stuff I've talked about.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. I think we have time for at least one more caller. Let's go to Jim in Boulder Creek. Hello, Jim, and welcome to the show.
Hi, doctor, and thank you for your show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. What can I do for you today?
I've had tinnitus for about a week and a half now.
How old are you, Jim?
56.
Okay. And did the tinnitus start after a loud sound like, fireworks going off on that side or anything?
No, but I have had ear damage on both ears for quite a while. One was some idiot threw a M80 through the air, and it blew up by my right ear many years ago. And my left ear was from a drunk driver hitting me many years ago. And putting me in intensive care. And anyway, I lost that hearing for about a year, but it came back.
Okay. One of the things you need to do, since it's just started and came on suddenly, get someone to look in the air and see if you've got a wax plug. Because a lot of times you've got tinnitus because the brain isn't getting enough signal that it's cranked up the gain. Do you remember those old tape recorders that were sound actuated, and when nobody was talking, it would get really hissy?
Yes.
And that was because the sensor said, oh, there's no sound. I better turn it up to be sure I get any sound that comes.
Right.
Well, your brain does exactly the same thing.
Okay.
So if you're blocked in the external auditory canal and you open up that blockage, then the tinnitus goes away. It's still there waiting to come back because it's a distortion in the signal. And once you crank up the gain, then that distortion becomes noticeable. The other possibility is if you're congested, if your ears have been popping, if you've got a runny nose, because the eustachian tube can block the middle ear. And if the sound's blocked either in the external ear or the middle ear, and it's not getting to the inner ear, then you will have tinnitus, and that's something you can do something about.
Okay.
So explore those two things first. If both of those don't pan out and you're getting nowhere, then I always want to put in a pitch for alternative things where I think they're appropriate. And tinnitus responds to acupuncture about half the time.
Oh.
I've seen it respond to chiropractic manipulation like cranial sacral stuff. This is purely anecdotal. I don't know of any placebo studies or anything like that. But I do know that when you have tinnitus and you go see the ear, nose, and throat guy, he says, here, live with it, or here's a sound generator to try to mask it. We don't have anything in conventional medicine at all for this. And so that's the moment to go think alternative in my book. So try the simple stuff first, like I've described, and call me back and let me know if that doesn't do it for you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Dr. Dawn for now saying so long and stay healthy.